What I Learned About Teaching at the Great Wall of China by Gary Squire. As I paused to gaze across the magnificent panorama spread before me, it struck me I was in another world, China. I had no idea that what I had imagined as a leisurely stroll on the Great Wall of China would turn out to be such a strenuous workout, much less a metaphor for my teaching experience in China. The wall, which snakes over the rugged mountain terrain at Badaling, 60 kilometers north of Beijing, presented a mostly uphill climb. After 2 hours of climbing, I felt the familiar endorphin rush and clear-headedness that I experience after a good run. What an extraordinary time and place to reflect on my first week of teaching in China. The first day. There I was, severely jet-lagged, on my first full day in China, standing in front of my class of 28 eager Chinese teachers. My students, all teachers of English in their own elementary schools, and selected to participate in this four-week English immersion program, had two expectations of the course. First, they wanted to improve their English skills, particularly the ability to speak and understand spoken English. Second, they expected to learn new and innovative teaching methods. Of course, my first challenge that day was staying awake. Day and night seemed completely reversed, and my body fought hard against the absurd times for sleeping, waking, and eating. Nevertheless, I felt confident, armed with my opening activities, a partner exercise in which everyone would be interviewed and then introduced by a classmate, and what I thought would be a delightful game with idioms. What a shock to realize with increasing clarity as the morning wore on that all of my carefully planned lessons completely missed the mark. The students were gracious and genuinely friendly, all the while utterly unable to make any sense whatsoever of my rapid-fire chatter and ever-changing arrangements with partners and small groups. As for the idiom activity, they obligingly went through the motions of finding the person with the matching idiom or explanation, and then tried with excruciating futility to explain the literal as well as colloquial meanings of the phrases. I practically stood on my head to help my students understand such idioms as making a mountain out of a molehill, while they frantically checked their electronic English translators for the meanings of molehill and every other word in my well-intended definition. I told them, it means to blow an issue or event out of proportion, such as, you have only a small blister on your heel, but you can complain as though you broke your leg. Why are you making a mountain out of a molehill? I used exaggerated sign language to clarify every word. Even then, I was faced with mostly blank looks and rapidly fading smiles. I could almost see the smoke rising from their nifty translating machines. Okay, I had to admit to myself, this lesson was a tad too complicated and the vocabulary far too extensive for novice English learners. In the afternoon, I introduced the children's story called The Hockey Sweater by Roch Carrier, which I had so cleverly chosen for its humorous Canadian content. As planned, I read the first few pages aloud, mustering superb expression to illustrate the plot, careful to pause long enough to define what I knew would be unfamiliar words. My students smiled and laughed continually. What a relief! They must have understood and thoroughly enjoyed the story, I thought. I instructed them to discuss with a partner their predictions of what would happen next and then write their ideas in their notebooks. My illusion that the students had at least a rudimentary grasp of the story was shattered that evening as I read their journals. Student after student, with the best spelling and grammar they could manage, thanked me for being their teacher, declared how much they appreciated my easygoing manner, and then, as politely as possible, proceeded to inform me that they understood nothing of the entire first day. Andrew asked, "What is meaning of idiom?" Declared Susan, "I don't understand sweeter story." How on earth did these teachers teach English, I wondered. I suspected that they used lots of very didactic, fill-in-the-blank vocabulary and grammar exercises, much as I did years ago when I tried to teach French to a sixth-grade class with my highly deficient French language skills. Hence, my first day was not exactly an ego-affirming experience. Recently retired after 30 years of teaching, I had had a fairly extensive and varied career with teaching stints in the education program at Simon Fraser University, with experiences teaching across many grade levels, and with 12 years as a principal under my belt. I was delighted with my new freedom, which afforded me the opportunity to take on special projects like this one, a one-month contract to teach in Fangshan, a city close to Beijing. However, I now found myself in a very unfamiliar setting, struggling to find the appropriate curriculum and effective means of teaching it to meet the unique needs of my adult Chinese students. Ah, but the challenge was exhilarating. I went right to work late that first night, which was certainly not a problem in my then wide-awake condition, to revise my plans for the next day. My mantra became, slow down and simplify. Getting it right. Getting it right was easier said than done. Much to my surprise, my teaching on the second day was only slightly better than it had been on the first. In spite of my appeals to my students to ask me for clarification during class, most of them were much too polite or shy to express their needs so openly. Thankfully, there emerged one or two of the bolder students to remind me to talk slow, please. It was apparent that most of them were unaccustomed to so much interaction in the classroom, both between student and teacher and between students. To say that most students were hesitant to ask a question or express an idea in class is an understatement. Only in their journals did they express their thoughts and feelings, confessing to me that they felt somewhat lost too much of the time. Obviously, I still needed to revise my teaching strategies significantly if I was to help my students to achieve the program's objectives. When I mentioned to my students that I planned to visit the Great Wall on the weekend, they were very excited for me. They told me a little of the history and folklore of this famous site. Some took great delight in informing me that one of the rites of passage into manhood requires a trip to the Great Wall. In hindsight, I wondered if they had a premonition that my hike on the wall would mark a turning point for my teaching assignment in China. I found the Great Wall and the surrounding scenery to be truly awe-inspiring. As I walked on the wall, my mind kept wandering back to the events of the previous week in the classroom. It must have been a combination of the crisp air, the exhilarating exercise, and the breathtaking landscape that prompted me to think more clearly and begin to find solutions to my classroom dilemmas. When I returned to the school on Monday, I felt invigorated with fresh insights, and in the days that followed, my instruction improved substantially. I continued to use children's literature, a personal passion, as a focus for instruction. But now the story segments for each day's lesson became shorter, and I placed more emphasis on the explicit teaching of new vocabulary. I used PowerPoint for effective visuals. Perhaps most important, I led the students in repetitive choral readings of the story passages. Then I instructed them to practice reading the passages again in small groups. Often, I asked them to perform role plays to illustrate the evolving plot line. Finally, it was all coming together. The students were getting it, and we were all having fun in the process. I was fully aware that the students had taught me at least as much as I had taught them. My exhaustive list of teaching methods that I had originally intended to cover was pared down to the most basic ideas. I began by confronting what seemed to be my students' assumption that a teacher's role is to stand and deliver while students sit quietly absorbing the proffered wisdom. I drew a chart to illustrate the differences between passive and active learning. We listed the active exercises we had already done, such as the oral reading they performed in small groups, and the passive ones, such as listening to me read a story. They agreed with my suggestion that they were all quite successful passive learners in an education system that stresses rote memory and the passing of an endless series of exams beginning in early primary school. I was pleased that they also accepted the proposition that a daily dose of active learning in the classroom could enhance the learning environment significantly for their students, who learned best by performing actions and talking about what they were learning. I wondered, dare I introduce the concepts of multiple intelligences and differentiated instruction? No, the finer points and certainly the educational jargon could wait. Remembering to keep it simple, I stopped myself from launching into a lecture and completely losing them and the main points in the process. From passive to active learning. Under the umbrella concept of active learning, we began to focus on cooperative learning and teaching for thinking. In the Chinese education system, which revolves around competition and individual success, not, I suppose, much different from our own system, learning to work together, actually helping one another to succeed, is quite a challenge. At first, when the students were instructed to take turns reading a short passage in their small groups, listening to and assisting each reader in turn, most of them very quickly lapsed into individual pursuits, such as copying the text into their notebooks or the ever-tempting habit of looking up words on their electronic translators. Always with humor, I steered them back to the intended task and insisted that the electronic gadgets disappear. These dandy devices had lost all of their allure for me, and I secretly wished that they would self-destruct. Gradually, through repeated debriefing sessions after these cooperative activities, many students began to realize that an emphasis on student-to-student interaction and assisting one another actually accelerated their individual learning. Specifically, spending substantial time on practicing speaking English supported learning to speak it, and more emphasis on listening to others speak facilitated improved understanding of spoken English. Why is it that ingrained habits can so often keep us from learning a new strategy that is quite simply a matter of common sense? Teaching for thinking was also quite an unusual idea for my students. I began to understand that, in China, being quiet and obedient is regarded as a sign of respect for such authority figures as parents and teachers. Perhaps my students considered independent thinking and, especially, expressing opposing views as quite improper and rather rebellious. I tried my best to convey that I did not wish to denigrate such a worthy virtue as respect for authority. Indeed, I was impressed by and greatly appreciated the respect that these adult students afforded me as their teacher. If only more Canadian classrooms consisted entirely of respectful young students. What I proposed was that teachers can purposefully structure many lessons to improve their students' higher level thinking skills without compromising a respectful environment. Thus, my students were introduced to a daily diet of oral and written assignments that had no singular right answers, but required the hard work of thinking through numerous possible answers, debating them, and reaching one's own conclusions. I used reader response, a strategy emphasizing the students' personal responses to literature, as a predominant component of the study of children's stories. In discussions with a partner and in small groups, followed by independent writing in reader response logs, the students practiced making predictions, describing characters, speculating on the author's viewpoints, and evaluating these views against their own. Teacher-led class discussions were another means for me to promote higher-level thinking. On each occasion, when I posed an open-ended question to the class, I was met with a prolonged silence. It seemed especially difficult for most of my students to express a thought or an opinion in the whole class setting. And yet, I was determined to demonstrate to them that a well-led discussion could be a valuable teaching strategy to support a classroom environment of thinking. Again, I tried humor, announcing that I could wait all day for the first brave person to say something and that no one was leaving until we had a good discussion. On each occasion, there was finally a breakthrough and a discussion took place. Obstacles to overcome in Chinese classrooms. During one of these discussions, I asked my students to describe the classrooms and schools where they taught their own young students. Eventually, a discussion surfaced on the topic of displaying student work on classroom walls, something they noted that I had done in our classroom, but that they rarely did in their schools. When asked to consider what my purpose might be in placing an abundance of student art, photographs, and written work on display in the classroom, they had no trouble finding several good reasons for this practice. So, my obvious question was why this was not done in Chinese classrooms. They informed me that they had no homeroom classes and had to move around from room to room, and furthermore, that their principals expected them to keep the walls clean. I asked them what they thought would happen if they discussed with their principals some of the new ideas they had learned in this program, including decorating the classroom with student work. In such a conversation, they could explain the rationale for this practice, encouraging students to take pride in their work and creating a warmer, more inviting classroom environment. After another silence, several students disclosed that they did not have such informal relationships with their principals, and that a teacher-initiated discussion of this sort would be highly unusual. Reading between the lines, I surmised that it was, once again, the lines of authority that were not to be crossed. My students also advised me that their classrooms consisted of 35 to 50 or more students, even in primary classes. I was well aware of the major challenges involved in introducing cooperative learning and open-ended class discussions in considerably smaller Canadian classes. So I wondered how these teachers would fare in classes jammed to the rafters with children, all talking and moving about at once, and how they would deal with the likely disapproval of their principals. The obstacles, I began to realize, were enormous. As the days went by It was wonderful to observe my students relax and genuinely enjoy the varied, fast-paced activities, as well as the freedom to express themselves in so many ways. On the other hand, I wondered if, for them, the program was merely a lovely holiday from the real world of Chinese classrooms. In the safe seclusion of my classroom, with a zany foreign teacher who not only granted them permission to experiment, but insisted that they participate, it was relatively easy for them to try new methods. Did these teachers think for 1 minute that they would implement the concepts and strategies they had learned, or were they simply overwhelmed by them? Had they resolved to maintain the status quo upon returning to their schools? But their district administrators, the ones with the real power, had gone to the considerable trouble and expense of providing these teachers with this opportunity with the express intent that they learn innovative teaching methods. Therefore, I thought, there must be hope for change in China's education system. After all, many other facets of Chinese society were changing quite dramatically. If there is hope for educational change in China, then I am happy to have been there to help plant some seeds. After the discussion about decorating the classroom walls with student work, several of my students wrote in their journals that they were quite excited about this idea and thought that they could do it in spite of the barriers. Thus, something as simple as the display of student work might be a place to start for some of them. Others would find their own points of entry into the new teaching methods presented to them. The final week. The days and weeks flew by, and the final week of the program arrived. It seemed that so much had happened, and I was surprised at the close bond that had developed between me and so many of the students. How unfortunate that it was time to wrap it up, now that we were really cooking. More idioms to have fun with, perhaps. The last 2 days were dedicated to the final and major project, consisting of small group presentations in which each group taught a lesson to the rest of the class and me, demonstrating what they had learned in the program. The presentations, intended as lessons the teachers could duplicate in their own classes, centered on a chosen children's story and required the ample use of active learning strategies. Without exception, every group taught a very impressive lesson. Much preparation was evident in the use of visual aids, props, and handouts. Each lesson involved such active student participation as choral reading, role-playing, games, and lots of cooperative and higher-level thinking activities. I could barely believe that these were the same people who, on the first day of the program, had said they understood nothing I tried to teach them. With obvious ease, they so artfully demonstrated all of the expected teaching methods. They also exemplified team teaching at its best. Most of all, I was astonished by the tremendous joy expressed in their teaching. Every teaching team obviously was having a great deal of fun, which was contagious for the rest of us, their stand-in students. We laughed all day long on those last 2 days. At the same time, I was well aware of the depth of their understanding of the concepts taught in the course and impressed with how confidently many of them spoke English. In addition, I got the distinct impression that they were quite practical about what they perceived they could do and how fast they could proceed upon returning to their own schools. Nevertheless, they seemed to be remarkably optimistic about their ultimate success. Where did they get this refreshing notion that practicality and idealism are completely compatible? What an attitude for achieving success! How could I ever have doubted their potential to incorporate new teaching methods, however gradually, into their own teaching? They were, after all, already experienced, highly competent teachers. They had every right to be confident of their abilities. I hope their leaders give them the credit and support that they deserve. If they do, the sky's the limit. In the weeks following my return home, I received many emails from my Chinese students in which they thanked me generously for teaching them. I'm very happy that they learned a thing or two from me, but honestly, I think my learning surpassed theirs. For that, I thank the students for my incredible teaching and learning experience. Come to think of it, throughout my career, all of my best teaching has coincided with my own peaks in learning. As it turned out, my trek on the Great Wall was a defining moment of my teaching experience in China. It was there, while drinking in such splendid scenery, that I began to clearly understand the unique needs of my students and, consequently, to revise my teaching. Perhaps it was a rite of passage after all. In this case, the latest reinventing of this teacher.